Talk number three is called Milarepa and His Heart Sons. So we've had this picture of Milarepa living in the mountains, in the caves, amongst the ice and the snow, the forests, the streams, the wild animals. And he loved that lifestyle. But it's also always said that the natural activity of enlightenment is compassion. The mind of enlightenment is wisdom, the activity of enlightenment is compassion. In other words, engagement and involvement with the needs of others is an inherent part of enlightenment. So we do have this strange apparent contradiction, which I think I raised in the first talk. How can this chap, living so remotely, so cut off, actually help other people? And yet, he had an enormous influence. And in fact, apparently the Bodhisattva precepts forbid even a vow of silence. That is a long-term vow of silence because of the importance of communication of the Dharma. So somehow Milarepa managed to maintain this uncompromising insistence on meditating in remote places for most of his life, while still meeting a lot of people, a very large number of people, and having a huge influence. And one of the reasons I think I mentioned in the first talk was because each meeting was very, very significant. So he could have an impact in a very short space of time. Now, he did visit farms and villages. He didn't stay in the caves all the time. He would wander around, partly for practical reasons, because he needed to stock up on barley flour. And he would meet people and teach people then. But at other times, of course, people would come to him, and as his reputation grew, more and more people would come and seek him out, and sometimes it would take a long time to find him as well. And he would sing. He would teach by singing. And in the last talk, I gave some examples of his teaching songs. First of all, I mentioned how his very way of life was a teaching, and sometimes his songs simply celebrate that way of life. He compares himself to the lioness or the vulture living in the mountains, at home there. And I also quoted a song about renunciation, another one about commitment. And also, do you remember the little one as an example of his use of metaphors about how he describes his practice as if he was building a house? And then there was one on genuine Dharma practice. And then there was the one that was taught to the eight pigeons. You remember he met a pigeon with a necklace who turned out to be a sort of angelic girl in disguise. And that was on mindfulness, that one, that song. And then there was a song on ethical practice and one, his response when he saw the butchers in the marketplace. There was a song on the path of the six perfections, and finally there was a song on transiency. The lovely flowers of turquoise blue, destroyed in time by frost. This shows the illusory nature of all beings. This proves the transient nature of all things. Think, then you will practice the Dharma. So today I want to widen things out a little bit and briefly put Milarepa in the context of the tradition that he was part of. And this tradition later became known as the Kagyu tradition, or the Kagyupa, one of the four main schools of Tibetan Buddhism. And in a way, the Kagyupa starts not in Tibet, but in India. It starts with Naropa meeting his guru. And this is another fantastic story which one could devote a whole retreat to. But in brief, Naropa became a great Buddhist scholar, in fact so great that he became the abbot or the vice chancellor, if you like, of the University of Nalanda. And Nalanda University, which flourished at that time, 8th, 9th, 10th century, was huge. It dwarfs any modern British university. There may be one or two American ones that are of a similar size. 50,000 students. Nearly all of them were monks, were Buddhist monks, bhikkhus, studying Buddhism and meditating. And so he became the head of that monastery, of that monastic university. And one day, it said, he was sitting in the courtyard, or one of the many courtyards of Nalanda, with his back to the sun, reading his books. And he heard a noise behind him. He looked around, and this hideous hag had appeared. And she said, "Do you understand what you're reading?" She said, "Do you understand the letter of what you're reading?" And he said, "Yes." And she cackled with laughter. And then she said, "Do you understand the spirit of what you're reading?" And since she'd been so pleased by his previous answer, he thought, "Yeah, well, yes." And then she burst into tears and stamped her feet. And she said, "You do not understand the spirit." She said, "The only person who can teach you the spirit of what you're reading is my brother." And then there was a big flash and she vanished. And so Naropa was very strongly affected by this. And he went off to seek the old hag's brother, which was quite difficult because he had no idea of the name of the person he was seeking, let alone where he was. And he spent many years and had many, many most amazing adventures until finally he met his teacher, who was known as Tilopa. And Tilopa put him through ordeals, compared with which the ordeals that Marpa put Milarepa through are absolutely as nothing. But I'll leave you to look that up if you're interested. But Naropa and Tilopa before him sort of started this lineage of this very intensive practice and the intensive relationship with a teacher. And Naropa in particular taught the six yogas of Naropa, which include the inner heat practice, they include dream yoga, the illusory body yoga, bardo yoga, and so on. These different yoga usually means intense meditation type practice. And he transmitted those along with what was known as the Mahamudra, the great seal teaching, which is still the central teaching of the Kagyu lineage and is sometimes known as the union of bliss and emptiness. So Naropa was, of course, the teacher of Marpa. Marpa was already a Buddhist in Tibet, but he decided to travel to India to get a fuller body of teachings and also to bring texts back to be translated. He was known as Marpa the Translator. He went to India three times. Each time he met up with Naropa, and Naropa spent a lot of time with him. On one occasion he spent 12 years in India, and Naropa taught him everything he knew, and he brought that back, and it's that that he then taught to Milarepa. And so you get this very strong sense, maybe starting from this really in Tibetan Buddhism, of lineage, of a master transmitting the teachings, the secret teachings to the disciple. And then we have Milarepa himself. And Milarepa continues the process, but it's as if the lineage starts to blossom and branch, because Milarepa was such a talented teacher. And he said that he had 8 heart sons and 4 daughters, as it were, 4 main female disciples, 8 main male disciples, and many, many other disciples as well as those main ones. And he once had a dream in which he met a girl who was blue in colour and had golden hair. And she showed him a lotus with 8 petals, and he himself was sitting in the middle. And he realised when he woke up that this was a reference to the 8 branches that would come from him, the 8 heart sons that he would have. So I'm going to do, in this talk today, I'm going to introduce you to some of these heart sons. We've already met one of them. Do you remember the hunter? The hunter, Repa, with his bow and arrow, his dog, chasing the black deer with spots. So he became one of Milarepa's heart sons, a very close disciple. In a minute, a few minutes, I'll introduce you to Rechungpa. Rechungpa he called his moon-like disciple. I'll also introduce you to another one, the shepherd Repa. And then finally there was his son-like disciple. And his son-like disciple was called Gampopa. And he was the most influential of all Milarepa's disciples. And in an institutional sense, he was the real founder of the Kagyu school of Buddhism, even though it harks back to Tilopa. He was a monastic, so he was very, very learned. He was unusual in that respect, in that he wasn't just someone who'd bumped into Milarepa and had an amazing experience. He was already, like Naropa, a learned Buddhist who'd been practicing as a monk, and he stayed as a monk. He didn't sort of think, oh, well, that's good, I can give all this up now. Milarepa didn't say to him, you know, no, a monk is no good. Milarepa was very happy with the monastic idea, as long as you were a sincere practitioner, which Gampopa was. And he learnt from Milarepa, and it said that he gained enlightenment. And then one day Milarepa and he parted. They knew they would never see each other again. And Milarepa said, I've got one more secret teaching to give you, and I want you to treasure this teaching in your heart. It's my most precious teaching, and I give it to very few people. And Gampopa said, oh, shall I prepare a mandala and some offerings, because of all these traditions about how you set up the ritual space to receive a teaching and memorize it and so on. And Milarepa said, no, that won't be necessary. Milarepa turned round, and he lifted up his robe and put it over his head and bent over and showed Gampopa his bottom. This was Milarepa's final teaching. And Gampopa looked at Milarepa's bottom, and he saw that it was covered in hardened skin, covered in calluses. And so the teaching was, meditate until your bum hurts, basically.
More air cushions.
So it was Gampopa who started, as I say, the Kagyu school. And always the Kagyu school did have a monastic element, but it also had the element of the yogin, the practitioners in the caves and the forests. And soon, after a few generations, it was headed up by the Karmapas, just if you, in case you want to tie some loose ends together. You may have heard of the Karmapa. The 17th Karmapa is now in his late 20s, I think. And there have been all sorts of adventures around the selection of the current Karmapa. And in fact, you may have heard, if you're not interested in Tibetan Buddhism in particular, you can just switch off for a while, but you may have heard of the tulku system. So the idea of a tulku is a reborn Buddhist teacher who is recognized by the followers and disciples of his or her previous incarnation, as it were. And this is how the Dalai Lamas are recognized, but it started with the Karmapas. So interestingly enough, Tibetan Buddhism had already been going for a good 800 years before they had any tulkus. And the very first tulku to be recognized was the second Karmapa. And because he was called the Karmapa, they decided to call the person he'd recognized as having been reborn from the first Karmapa. But that was retrospective, as happened also with the Dalai Lamas. 1283, that happened. So he was a disciple of a disciple of Gampopa, the second Karmapa. And this whole school continued to emphasize especially two things, which derived from Milarepa: intensive practice in remote places, and also a very close personal relationship with a teacher who taught on a very personal relationship, on a very personal basis. And this method of teaching was known as the ear-whispered transmission, or the ear-whispered teaching. And the word Kagyu means a tradition or a lineage of oral or ear-whispered teachings. That's the meaning of the word Kagyu. So there's a little bit of background there. Now I'd like to give you a couple of examples of Milarepa's heart sons, and the relationship he developed with them and the kind of teaching he gave them. The second one I'll talk about is The Shepherd. And The Shepherd gives me a chance just to say something about Milarepa's meditation teaching and something very little about his teaching of wisdom. But the first one is Rechungpa. And Rechungpa, who, before he was given that name, was an 11-year-old boy. And he'd been sent up into the high meadows to herd some cattle. And he heard singing, beautiful, melodious singing, coming from somewhere amongst the rocks. And you imagine that if you're an 11-year-old boy, you're wandering about up there, the cows are quite happily grazing, and you hear this singing, you know, it's like the Pied Piper, really, isn't it? And you sort of try to find its source. And he clambered amongst the rocks, and he found a cave, and there was this weird guy sitting in there, a scrawny old man with long hair, hardly any clothes, but bright eyes, and this sense of supreme bliss radiating from him. So this was Milarepa. And apparently the little boy had an overwhelming experience just on seeing Milarepa and hearing him sing. And he was really fascinated, and he sat with Milarepa and talked to him for a while, and eventually became his disciple. And he became Milarepa's closest and most beloved disciple. And the name Rechungpa means something like little cotton socks. Repa means the one who is clad in cotton. And so all of those who stayed with Milarepa in the caves, Mila was his family name. Repa means little, means a cotton-clad one. They were all known as Repas, various different Repas. There was the hunter Repa, there was the shepherd Repa, who we'll see in a minute, and here was Rechungpa. And Chung means the littlest, the young, because he's only 11. And before he met Milarepa, he used to earn money by going around reciting and reading Buddhist texts for his neighbours, because there wasn't all that much literacy around, so you could actually earn a good living by doing this. And his parents were very keen on this. In fact, they stopped bothering to do much work themselves because the boy could earn so much by doing this. And of course, when Rechungpa met Milarepa, this source of money dried up, much to his parents' dismay. And so they rushed up there and kidnapped him and dragged him back home again. So you can't stay up here, mate. You know, we need you down there. And as a punishment, they set him to work in the fields as well. And he contracted a serious skin disease of some kind, which is usually translated as leprosy. And eventually he ran away, went back to Milarepa again. And Milarepa insisted, when he met the parents, said he insisted, no, he's got to stay here. You can't just have him just for economic purposes. You know, he will be fine here. So Rechungpa stayed with Milarepa. And after a few years, he still had this skin complaint. And he decided to go to India because he met some Indian yogis who'd come to Tibet to see Milarepa. And they said, we know someone who can cure it. So Rechungpa went on his first journey to India. So like Marpa, Rechungpa went three times to India. Now, going to India didn't mean going to the station, catching a train, sitting on the train, getting off, you know, 12 hours later after a slightly uncomfortable journey, and there you are in India. It was not like that at all. It was a major undertaking. Not only were you going on foot over a very long distance, you were going through bandit-infested country, over mountains, trying to get across rivers, and going down onto the plains into this weird, sweaty, humid, hot place, which for the Tibetans was most peculiar. But Rechungpa loved it. He was amazed. He was one of those people, he was very easily distractible, and he loved anything new, and he was amazed by his experience of India. It was the center of world civilization, as far as he was concerned, and with some justification, actually, in those days. And while he was there, he found all sorts of books on Buddhism and all sorts of fascinating teachers. And he'd actually left in the autumn, and Milarepa said, while you're away, I'm just going to do a bit of meditation. Could you warm me up, please? So Rechungpa walled him up. This is what you do. Wall him up, make a clay wall with a little hole in it, and the meditate. This is how you do a long solitary retreat. So Rechenpa doesn't get back till the following spring. Yes. And he goes up. I wonder where Milarepa is nowadays, you know. And as he was going up into the mountain where the cave was, he asked the local people and said, yeah, we do. We remember last year there was a funny yogi around, but nobody's seen him. No, he's not around. And Rechenpa went up to the cave. The wall was completely untouched. And he knew there'd been this really hard winter. And he was really upset. He thought, my master, my teacher is dead inside that cave. And so he starts to scrabble at the clay and open it up and look through. And there, as if he's just left yesterday, is Milarepa sitting bolt upright in meditation. So Rechenpa was very, very relieved, very pleased to see him, this calm, solid mountain, very happy with his simple life, unlike Rechenpa. So India made things worse for Rechenpa. He was full of all sorts of new ideas. He was full of excitement. And Milarepa used to try to persuade Rechenpa just to stay with him and meditate intensively. But before too long, Rechenpa would get restless and he'd decide to go off on some journey. So I'll give you an idea of what he's like with a dialogue and a song between Milarepa and Rechenpa. And this was when Rechenpa got back from his third journey to India. So Milarepa says, now, let's go to the mountains and meditate. Milarepa was always saying this to Rechenpa, and Rechenpa was, oh, come on, can't we do something more interesting? Rechenpa said, I'm very, very tired. I've still got jet lag. My physical strength has reached the point of exhaustion, he says. I think it best if I go to a nearby monastery with a kitchen to recover my strength. Otherwise, I won't be able to meditate or travel at all. Milarepa said, if you're determined from the bottom of your heart, you can practice under any circumstances at any time. Which I think is worth pondering. You know, it's interesting, that one, isn't it? So, might want to talk about it in the groups. He says, you can practice under any circumstances at any time, if you want to do so from the bottom of your heart. And then Milarepa gave this song, responding to Rechenpa's request for a bit more comfort. My son Rechenpa, as your monastery, be content with your own body, for the bodily substance is the palace of the devas. As a teacher, be content with your own mind, for knowledge of the truth is the beginning of spirituality. As your sutra, be content with outward things, for they are all symbols of the liberation path. I'll just repeat that one because I might come back to it. As your sutra, but your text, be content with outward things, for they are all symbols of the liberation path. As food, be content to feed on ecstasy, for the Buddhas will come and sustain you. As clothing, be content to put on the inner heat, for the Dakinis wear the warmth of bliss. For companions, be content to cut off all ties, for solitude is the president of the assembly of the devas. To regard all enemies as passers-by on the road is to avoid hatred. The best remedy for obstacles is to meditate on voidness, for they are all magic like plays of the mind. This is the right way for you to follow. If you want to meditate, you may come along with me to my cave. If you don't, you can do whatever you like. And Milarepa was just about to set off. And Rechenpa grabbed hold of his clothing just in time to stop him. And he sang a song, sort of trying to bring it all down to earth, of the eight. He calls it the Song of the Eight Needs. Rechenpa was also a very fine singer, I should say, and they often would sing in duets, he and Milarepa. Though the best monastery is one's own body, we need a place for cover and sleep. Without mercy, the rain and wind attack all. Because of this, we always need a monastery. And he goes through the other needs as well. Just the basic needs. We don't, come on, Milarepa. You know, I understand what you're saying. Very good. Yeah, good allegories and things. But you need a roof over your head. You do need a bit of food, don't you? You know, I'm not asking for much. Just a little library, you know. Maybe an iPad and maybe, you know... a DVD player. And, you know. So another 8 verses, Rishumpa goes on, saying what we always need: food, clothing, friends, protection from enemies, safeguards against demons, and so on. And Milarepa briefly replies, well, if you've got confidence, you can take Milarepa's approach. Otherwise, there'll always be a need for something. But Milarepa, interestingly, is not inflexible. And seeing that Rishumpa is determined to go to a village and have a rest, Milarepa agrees to go there too. But he says, however, let's go there to teach Dharma, not just for a rest. In fact, that's Milarepa's idea of a break from serious practice, is going and giving Dharma talks. But when Rishumpa came back from his third journey to India, there was something even more obvious than his restlessness, and this was his pride. And he was so pleased with himself. He'd got all these wonderful books, and apparently a few of them were very important texts known as the formless Dakini Dharmas, but some were just books on logic and even books on black magic, which he thought he needed to help protect Milarepa. And he'd received teachings from some very impressive people, some of them Hindu, some Buddhist, and he even had Dipupa's magic staff, which somehow he managed to get hold of and taken back to Tibet. And he gave this as a gift to Milarepa. So when he first approached Milarepa's humble cave on the return from the third journey from India, he was thinking to himself, well, I'll be very, very respectful to my old teacher, poor chap, stuck here in Tibet all this time, but now my learning is far superior to his, so I hope he recognises that and performs the reasonable prostrations before me as the superior teacher. So he's got this pride as well as this wanderlust and an unbalanced reverence for teachings which are written down, as opposed to these ear-whispered ones that he's been getting. So I think at first, I suppose it's not surprising, since he started off at 11, he really reveres Milarepa more as a father than as a spiritual friend, and his rebellion is the rebellion of a son to a father as well, which is quite interesting. But I quite like him. I mean, maybe for all these reasons I quite like him. His rebellion, his confusion, his inconsistency, he can't sort his priorities out, he's rather immature, he's rather fickle. In other words, he's rather normal. So it's a bit reassuring. You know, I can identify with somebody like Rishumpa, which is why they're particularly good stories to read. There's a number of stories involving Rishumpa in the songs of Milarepa. And he doesn't realise that he's already got the conditions that he needs. He's actually got the best teacher he's likely to find right there with him. All he needs to do is get down to his practice. And I think, I mean, I can relate to this. You know, sometimes I'm a bit dissatisfied with the simplicity of the meditation practice. You know, I know that one. You know, I've already learnt that one. Couldn't I have something a bit more different, you know, a bit more exotic? But really, I've already got all the practices, all the Dharma teachings that I need, or even more than I need. And also, what about a greater guru? Wouldn't it be nice to have a wonderful enlightened guru? I mean, this is Rishumpa, of course. He's got Milarepa and he's still not satisfied. He thinks, you know, maybe I could find someone who's got a bit more qualifications, you know. He wanted someone who fitted his preconceptions better. And I think the same again in our own way goes for us. Maybe one could find a very impressive Tibetan Lama guru who would grant you initiation. I know people who do this, who go off and look for a guru in this way. But the unfortunate thing is, if they're very lucky, they see them for half an hour once a year, and often it's less than that. So, you know, even I'm not saying anything against them as teachers, but the fact is, what real use are you going to get of meeting somebody who doesn't speak your language for half an hour once a year? And in the end, what you'll do, of course, with any luck, you'll mix with the other disciples. You'll have a sangha in that way, and you'll have all the books and all that kind of thing that you can read. But you haven't really got a teacher, in a sense. And if you feel this, my suggestion which is a little bit obvious, I suppose, is that just to consider the people that you're already in contact with. You know, Rachungpa already had Milarepa. Maybe we haven't got a Milarepa, but consider the people you already know. Are there any of them that you actually respect? Not that you think are enlightened or think are perfect and wonderful, but just who you respect, who've got more experience. And if there is someone like that, then ask yourself, am I making full use of this connection I've got with him? Are you helping him out in any beneficial activity that he engages in? Do you take him seriously? Are you getting to know him more closely? Are you allowing his perspective to help you with your practice? And if you're not doing all these things, then what makes you think that you'd be able to do them if you had a wonderful enlightened teacher? You're not even doing it just with an ordinary person you respect, if you see what I mean. Or maybe more than one. I don't mean it has to be one. It could be a number fulfilling different needs. So there's Rachungpa. He's filled with pride. And this actually turns into serious resentment when Milarepa will not accept Rachungpa's judgment of his new status as a wonderfully qualified spiritual master. And this is what Milarepa says in his song. Oh, Rachungpa, your mind is like a nimble bird. Now it flies high, now it swoops low. You should observe this unstable change. Stop thinking so much and devote yourself to the Repa's practice. Rachungpa, your enlightenment is like the sun and the moon. Sometimes they shine bright, but sometimes they are darkened by clouds. You should observe this unstable change. Stop thinking so much and devote yourself to the Repa practice. But something in this particular story, which is called Milarepa and the Yak Horn, if you want to look it up, something else happens. And you remember that in the first song I quoted, Milarepa said that outer things suffice as one's sutras. And this was a lesson that was to come very soon. So Rachungpa was taught not by Milarepa, but by the world. And this is what happened. So Rachungpa was getting a bit bored with being told off. And so he said, come on, Milarepa. Look, there's some tents over there. I'm really hungry. Let's go and get some food. I'm starving. And Milarepa tries to dissuade him. He says, no, it's not the time to seek for alms at this time in the evening. You know, that would be very rude of us to do that. But Rachungpa insisted. And Milarepa said, okay, we'll go to the first tent and see if they've got any food. And then Rachungpa starts up again with all his thinking. And he says, no, he says, no, when you beg, you should always give the poorest people the chance to gain merit. So look at that scruffy little tent over there. We'll go there, shall we? And Milarepa, you can imagine going, oh, God, here we go again. And off they go to the little scruffy little tent in the corner. And a fearful old woman came out of the tent and started shouting at them, you yogis, you should always stick to poverty rather than asking us for stuff. Greedy people like you are never content with what you've already got. You're always coming to try and get my belongings. She says, I've already given everything I could possibly spare to some beggars this morning. I've got nothing left at all. Go away. In fact, she used rather stronger language than that. So they had to give up. And by this time, it was too late to go to the other tents, and they had to make do without any food that night. And they were just sleeping not far away, and at midnight, a strange noise came from the old lady's tent, and then everything was quiet. And when the sun rose, Milarepa said to Rachungpa, you better go and check that old woman in the tent. And so Rachungpa went, and she died during the night. And the narrator says that there were some terrible epidemics in the land at the time. And despite her stingy talk of the night before, her time had come. And already by this stage, the nomads in the other tents had stolen all her belongings and gone. So all that was left was the little scruffy tent with the dead woman inside it. And there was also a small bag of butter and cheese and some barley flour and a pot of yogurt. So she had actually been lying when she said she had nothing. So the two of them performed a ceremony, a funeral ceremony for the old woman. Rechungpa was about to go away with the remains of the food for breakfast. And Madarepa said, no, we must treat her property with respect and dig a grave for her. So Rechungpa, poor old Rechungpa, had to carry the body some distance to where there was some earth, because there's not much earth in Tibet where you can dig graves. And he dug a grave, and he was actually quite bothered as well, because he'd heard about the epidemics, and he's having to carry this woman's body. So Milarepa pointed to the heart of the corpse with the staff of Dipupa, his present that Rechungpa had brought for him. He said, Rechungpa, like this woman, everybody is destined to die, but seldom do people think of this fact, so they lose many opportunities to practice the Dharma. Both you and I should remember this incident and learn a lesson from it. And then he sang one of his most heartfelt and beautiful songs, I think, and I'll just give you a few verses from it, which is known as the Song of Transiency and Delusion. Oh, the grace of the gurus is beyond our comprehension. When the transiency of life strikes deeply into one's heart, his thoughts and deeds will naturally accord with Dharma. If repeatedly and continuously one thinks about death, he can easily conquer the demon of laziness. No one knows when death will descend upon him, just as this woman last night. Rechungpa, do not be harsh and listen to your guru. Behold, all manifestations in the outer world are ephemeral like the dream last night. One feels utterly lost in sadness when he thinks of this passing dream. Rechungpa, have you completely awakened from the great puzzlement? Oh, the more I think of this, the more I aspire to the Buddha and the Dharma. When I look at the fortunes of the rich, they appear to me like honey to the bees. Hard work, serving only for others' enjoyment, is the fruits of their labor. When I think of this, my heart is filled with grief. Rechungpa, do you not want to open the treasury within your own mind? Oh, the more I think of this, the more I aspire to the Buddha and his teachings. So they buried the old woman, and a very sober Rechungpa set off with Milarepa to complete their journey. And he did apply himself with great humility and perseverance to his meditation practice, and his receptivity to Milarepa was restored, particularly after this incident. And eventually he gained enlightenment. He completely awakened from his great puzzlement. The song speaks for itself, really. But it is interesting. There was this old woman, bad tempered, desperately clinging onto her food, and that night she died. And this is something incredibly real when this happens. You know, there she was, sort of full of her life and her obsessions, and then a few hours later, she's just a corpse. And in a way, I have that feeling that there's nothing more real than death. Mm. When my own father died, I had that sense. I kept dreaming of him, actually, for some months afterwards. And then I'd wake up, and dreaming of him alive, and then I'd wake up, and I had to face the fact that he's actually dead. I will never speak to him again. He's actually gone completely. So death is very real. And the difficult thing to appreciate is that my own death, even though it hasn't actually happened yet, is just as certain. I had to accept my father's death, but to accept my own is rather more difficult. The reality of it actually going to happen. I don't know what will happen in the future, but I can be 100% certain that one of the things that will happen is me dying. Mm. I don't know when, I can't know when, but it will definitely happen. So death is a message from reality. It's a message of impermanence. Maybe this is why Milarepa starts his song by saying, the grace of his teachers is beyond our comprehension, because this was the teaching that Rechungpa really needed. Milarepa couldn't convey it, only the woman's death finally got it through to him, that he had to sort of let go of all his obsessions. And so this sense of transience is very central to Buddhism. Once upon a time, Bhante Sangharakshita gave a talk in India, and the talk was called Buddhism in One Word. And when I saw the title, I thought, well, I wonder what that is. What's the one word that sums up Buddhism? Is it Buddha or Dharma? Or is it Pratityasamutpada? No, that's two words. It can't be that. But the one word, of course, is impermanence. The fact of death, big deaths of people, small deaths, deaths of a phase in your life, of old ideas, of beautiful experiences, relationships, and so on and so on. The fact of death is really impermanence speaking most loudly and clearly. And I think that if I was given more than one word to sum up what it meant to be a Buddhist, I might say that you don't actually have to believe in the Buddha himself to be a Buddhist. You don't have to believe in rebirth. You don't have to believe in any particular doctrine. In a way, all you have to believe in is that change is real, that we are changing all the time, and that we can discover how to direct this change for the benefit of ourselves and others. If you don't believe that, then it's very difficult, if not impossible, to be a Buddhist. If you've got a sense of the reality of change, and also the directability of change, that we don't just have to put up with what happens randomly happening to us, we can actually do something about it. That is the Dharma. The whole Dharma follows from that, I would say. I mean, talk about it in your groups tomorrow if you like, but I'd say that the whole Dharma follows from that. So impermanence is both a fact and a challenge, and it also gives us the only possible hope for making things better. If anything was fixed, everything would be fixed, unless the fixed thing had no relation to anything else. But if you have a fixed thing, if it's connected to other things, then it freezes the whole universe. Similarly, as soon as you accept any real impermanence, in a way you have to accept that everything is impermanent. Everything that connects with that, everything that connects with you, changes. Which means that we are not stuck, that we're never actually stuck in our present predicament, which would be a horrible thought. So Milarepa says in that song, when the transiency of life strikes deeply into one's heart, his thoughts and deeds will naturally accord with Dharma. So impermanence is the Dharma. If repeatedly and continuously one thinks about death, he can easily conquer the demon of laziness. So the fact of impermanence makes spiritual life possible, and it also makes it urgent, since we don't know how long we've got. And we don't know what happens after death. You know, you may have ideas about rebirth or something, but how do you know? I mean, actually, we just go into the unknown at that point. So until then, that is our chance. We've got this fantastic chance, and it is a great shame to waste it. Human life is as precarious as a single slim hair of a horse's tail. This is later in the same song. Hanging on the verge of breaking. It may be snuffed out at any time, like this old woman was last night. Don't cling to this life, Rachungpa. Listen to my song. But Milarepa also explains that there's no need for insecurity. Insecurity only comes because the mind is clinging, because it won't fly free. And Milarepa says that his heart is filled with grief when he thinks of this clinging mind. We had a bit of a chat in our group, actually, about how come somebody who's filled with bliss the whole time, so happy and enlightened, keeps on talking about sadness and grief? And that might be worth talking about as well in the groups. And Milarepa appeals to Rachungpa beseechingly, telling him, you can't afford to indulge any negative emotions. And he says again in the same song, when I look back at my clinging mind, it appears like a short-lived sparrow in the woods, homeless and with nowhere to sleep. When I think of this, my heart is filled with grief. Rechungpa, will you let yourself indulge in ill will? Oh, the more I think of this, the more I aspire to Buddha and the Dharma. When I observe inwardly my breathing, I see that my breaths are transient like the fog. They may vanish any moment into nothing. When I think of this, my heart is filled with grief. Rechungpa, do you not want to conquer that insecurity now? Oh, the more I think of this, the more I aspire to the Buddha and the Dharma. So that's I found it quite affecting, that, and in a way this is just a little bit of a snapshot of Milarepa's relationship with Rechungpa, the way he teaches him, the way he uses things that just happen to them, weak or strong, as always a means of approaching just this is what's really going on. Are you going to turn away from it, or are you going to turn towards it? So I want to move on from there now and talk a bit about meditation and wisdom. And in a second, I'll tell another story. Is that all right? It's 10 to 9 now. Do you mind if we have a little bit more? You can't really say no, can you? I don't know why I'm asking. No, stop there. And that's the story of the shepherd boy. But before that, just a little song that gives a few little tips on meditation. And I've got a handout again with these songs that I'm quoting tonight in it, so you can have a look at them. So this little one goes like this. Carve upon your mind stone the word diligence. When you feel sleepy during meditation, try to pray hard with your awakened body, mouth, and mind. When the fire spark of wisdom dims, try to inflame it with the wind of mindfulness. If you want to be freed from samsara's prison, practice hard without diversion. But to take that sense of working in meditation a bit further to what happens when you're really getting deeply into meditation, I thought I'd give you a little bit of the story of the shepherd. This chapter in the book is called The Shepherd's Search for Mind. And it's a remarkable boy who turns up. In fact, two of them turn up. They're both 16, and they've been herding the sheep. And they sort of turn up at Milarepa's cave, peering in, you know, who's this funny chap here, you know. And the younger one says to Milarepa, he says, who do you live with then? Because looking around, you know, you can't imagine anyone living alone, especially in Tibet where family life is so important. And Milarepa says, yeah, I live with friend Bodhicitta, he says. In other words, the awakening mind. That's who I live with. And the boy is actually intrigued by this reply, and he goes on to ask Milarepa about mind. I don't know if you remember when you were 16, but it's the kind of age when you're really interested, sometimes, when you're not asleep. You're really interested in what really matters, you know, and you'd really prick your ears up when you came across something like that. So Milarepa said, I'm not going to tell you what mind is. Go home and look for it. So the shepherd boy says, oh, all right then. So he goes home and looks for it, and he comes back the next day, and Milarepa says, did you find it? And what happens over the next few days is Milarepa keeps giving him a little exercise to do and sends him home to do it, and then he comes back the next day and reports. So the second day, he says, okay. He says, I couldn't really find it. It was quite difficult, really. Tell me, what is it? And Milarepa says, by merely hearing of the taste of sugar, sweetness cannot be experienced. Only the tongue can know it. In the same way, one cannot see in full the nature of mind, though he may have a glimpse of it, if it's only been pointed out by others. If one continues searching for the nature of mind, he will see it fully in the end. Dear shepherd, in this way you should observe your mind. And he says, okay, tonight I want you to tell me what colour is it, what shape is it, and exactly where in your body is it. So the shepherd says, oh, all right then. He goes home and he sort of tries hard, you know, and comes back again. I won't give you read the whole story if you want to know all the details of the conversation. It's very interesting. And Milarepa, the next day, when he says, actually, it hasn't really got a shape or a colour or even a location. It's very weird. And Milarepa says, it's very, very important. Your mind is very important. It can be a prisoner in the prison of samsara, but it can also free us from samsara. Your mind is the key. It's really crucial. And he shows him then, he thinks he's ready. He says, okay, I'll show you how to go for refuge to the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. So in a way, he says, okay, I will take you on and I'll give you some training in the Dharma. And he says, okay, now go home and I want you to keep on reciting to the Buddha for refuge I go, to the Dharma for refuge I go, to the Sangha for refuge I go, Buddhang Saranangachami, Dhammang Saranangachami, Sanghang Saranangachami. And I want to come back tomorrow and tell me, who is it who is going for refuge? And so the little boy says, oh, okay. He runs home, he sits there, Buddhang Saranangachami, trying to work out who it is who goes for refuge. And day by day, this training goes on. And what the shepherd boy discovers is his ego and his ego clinging. And Milarepa gets him to visualize the Buddha. So he says, first of all, do it again, the refuges. Recite the refuges again. And then visualize a Buddha sitting on the end of your nose. All right? And so he goes home, visualizes the Buddha. And Milarepa doesn't see him again. 7 days later, the boy's parents turn up and say, have you seen him? He says he hasn't been home. We can't find him anywhere. And Mirabh said, well, he was here a week ago. And so this big search, and they find him sitting in the bottom of a clay pit with his eyes closed. And they give him a shake and say, where have you been? He says, no, I'm meditating. Go away, I'm meditating. And they said, yeah, but you've been sitting here for 7 days, isn't it? And he says, no, rubbish, I've been here for an hour or so. You know, he completely loses track of time. In fact, he becomes totally useless, basically. And in the end, his parents say, look, come on. Go and live with Milarepa. I mean, obviously, you've got to get into this, haven't you? It's probably just a phase you're going through, but you've got to get into this. And so they're quite nice people, his parents. And off he goes, and he lives with Milarepa, and he trains up with Milarepa. And this is what Milarepa sings to him about meditation once he's had some deep realizations, once he's got really absorbed in meditation. I don't know if that's ever happened to you, where you've got really deeply absorbed in meditation, and it's really felt very spacious, maybe very little of any thinking going on. It's just, and it all seems so normal in a way. You just think, wow, you know, why are things not like this all the time? Alas, says Milarepa, those proficient yogis who long have practiced meditation tend to mistake the psychic experience of illumination for transcendental wisdom, and they are happy with this form of self-deception. So he's warning him, he's saying, you can feel you've got it. You really can feel, this is what it's all about. I know now, you know. When your body is rightly posed and your mind absorbed deep in meditation, you may feel that thought and mind both disappear. Yet this is but the surface experience of dhyana. By constant practice and mindfulness on that, one feels radiant self-awareness shining like a brilliant lamp. It's pure and bright as a flower. It's like the feeling of staring into the vast and empty sky. This awareness of voidness is limpid and transparent, yet vivid. This non-thought, this radiant and transparent experience, is but the feeling of dhyana. With this good foundation, one should further pray to the three jewels and penetrate to reality by deep thinking and contemplation. He thus can tie the non-ego wisdom with the beneficial life rope of deep dhyana. With the power of kindness and compassion, and with the altruistic vow of the Bodhi heart, the Bodhicitta, he can see direct and clear the truth of the enlightened path, of which nothing can be seen, yet all is clearly visioned. He sees how wrong were the fears and hopes of his own mind. Without arrival, he reaches the place of the Buddha. Without seeing, he visions the Dharmakaya, the body of Dharma. Without effort, he does all things naturally. Dear son, the virtue seeker, bear this instruction in your mind. So I'm going to leave it with that talk, that song, that you might want to ponder. But I'll just repeat one or two of the phrases from it. So the first thing is this danger of getting deep experiences in meditation and thinking that's it, that is transcendental realization. And this is a really common danger for people that get into meditation deeply, of being satisfied and feeling, okay, that's it. And you need always to go further. And then Midarepa is then saying, well, okay, so you may get into dhyana. You may feel that thought and mind have disappeared. You feel in a non-dual sort of state. But this is only the surface experience of dhyana. It can go yet deeper. If you're mindful of it, you apply mindfulness. This is the trick with meditation. Whatever happens, apply mindfulness to it and see what happens if you let go of it. Then you can feel radiant self-awareness shining like a brilliant lamp, pure and bright as a flower, like the feeling of staring up into the sky. So this is the awareness of openness, of total openness that you may have in meditation, limpid, transparent, vivid, and without thought. This also is a dhyanic experience, he says. But with this good foundation, you pray to the three jewels. So in other words, dhyana, getting absorbed in meditation, is a very, very good foundation. The next stage is to remind yourself of the commitments that you've made, of the sense that you are not just looking for good experiences, you're looking to break through to wisdom and compassion, the wisdom and compassion of the Buddha. So that's why it says pray to the three jewels. And deep thinking and contemplation. So you don't neglect thinking and reflection. You realize it's very important not just to sort of become a blissed out yogi, but also to consider carefully your understanding of what's going on, your potential for delusion, how it fits into your other experiences and so on. Deep thinking and contemplation. And this allows you to tie the non-ego wisdom with the beneficial life rope of deep dhyana. So the deep dhyana is like a rope, and it brings together the wisdom experiences. Wisdom experiences without absorption will tend to be scattered and unstable, but absorption without wisdom experiences are of no permanent value. So the dhyana is a rope, the life rope, which ties together the non-ego wisdom experiences. And then with the power of kindness and compassion and the altruistic vow of the Bodhi heart, you see direct and clear the truth of the enlightened path. So then at that point, your path opens out towards you quite clearly. So long as you remember compassion, as long as you remember this is for the sake of the benefit of people in general, not just for good experiences for me. And then I'll just repeat again the last few lines, which are very like the lines you'll find in Hakuin's Song of Meditation. Zen and the Mahamudra of Milarepa really converge when they talk about meditation. He sees how wrong were the fears and hopes of his own mind. Without arrival, he reaches the place of the Buddha. Without seeing, he visions the Dharmakaya. Without effort, he does all things naturally. Bear this instruction in your mind.